Well, thank you all for coming out this afternoon. I know for a lot of people, it was probably a long drive through a lot of traffic. Apologize for starting a little bit late. I was actually in a lot of traffic as well. Hopefully, though, we'll have some good content today to make up for it. I have two talks I was going to talk about. The first was a talk on Visual Studio 2010 and .NET 4, specifically looking at some of the new improvements that are going to be coming out shortly that you'll be able to experience with the Beta 2 release. And I have a second talk that we can do after a break, which is on ASP.NET MVC. And we'll also talk specifically about some of the new features coming as part of that with the MVC 2.0 release, which happens to be included as part of Visual Studio 2010 and then also be available with the 2008 edition. So with that, I can go ahead and get started. My name is Scott Guthrie. I work in the developer division at Microsoft, and I run some of the teams that build kind of the core of .NET. So the CLR and base class libraries, and then ASP.NET, Silverlight, WPF, Windows Forms, and Visual Studio tools for doing client, web, and mobile development. So a few things. If you have any questions during the talk, feel free to raise your hand. Hopefully we can make this a little bit interactive and fun. This is the very first time I've ever given this talk, and some of the content is only about 6 hours old. Hopefully all the demos will go well, and I think you will be the very first audience ever anywhere in the world to see the build I'm going to be showing, and I can guarantee the only audience to ever see these demos because they were just written. So hopefully we can make it some fun. So as I mentioned, actually to preface this, this is all about Visual Studio 2010 and .NET 4. This is the release that's going to be coming out next year. We did an early beta 1 release in the first half of this year. It was a pretty early beta. We're going to have a beta 2 coming out in the not-too-distant future. We're just hopefully entering escrow on that, so we're going to be sitting on a couple builds for a while, just making sure we don't find any last-minute issues. And then hopefully it'll be public and you can download it, again, in the not-too-distant future. Let me start by talking about all the cool things I'm not going to talk about today. One challenge with this release is there's lots of good stuff coming. That's a good problem to have. It's a problem, though, when you're presenting it, which is there's no way to possibly fit it into only an hour and a half talk. So I thought I'd quickly just spend a whole bunch of time talking about really cool things that I'm not going to be covering over the next hour and a half. So specifically, I'm not going to be talking about any of the new language features coming. There's lots of great stuff coming in VB, C#, and F#, but you're not going to hear them from me. There's lots of work going in this release to WPF 4. Lots of cool tooling improvements for both WPF and Silverlight. There's now a great interactive designer inside Visual Studio 2005 for both WPF and Silverlight, so you can drag and drop controls. Full data binding support. You can apply styles, resources. Really great tooling support, but you're not going to hear that today. Improvements coming to Windows Forms. Great new multi-targeting support, new charting control support, and a bunch of other great features. Lots of deployment work coming as part of our new client SKU that we're coming out with .NET, so it makes it easier and faster to build client apps. Lots of improvements coming in WCF as well as workflow. We're actually integrating those two together nicely. New workflow designer, lots of new capabilities coming there. Visual Studio 2005 now has built-in SharePoint editing support, so you can now create, open, debug, and code against SharePoint directly within Visual Studio. Full list data binding support, lots of other great cool capabilities coming as part of that. New parallel extensions, so if you want to build multi-core systems, so basically be able to do multiple tasks in sequence. We have great debugger support, so you can visualize what's going on inside your apps. We have new BCL extensions as part of the base class libraries in .NET to allow you to write task-aware applications. Lots of good things coming there. New code contract support, so you can do kind of think of it as test asserts throughout your code that you can then do static analysis on. New framework called MEF, or the Managed Extensibility Framework, that allows you to kind of compose applications in a very rich way, as well as a whole bunch of new base class library improvements will be coming. We have a new version of TFS that's coming out. Makes it much easier to install and set up. Lots of great new features and scalability improvements for code for both source control, bug tracking, as well as build servers. We got lots of improvements coming as part of C++, MS Build project integration, which means you can now tie into TFS to do build servers, and a whole bunch of other improvements in performance. Lots of improvements in the enterprise tool support with VSTS, new architect SKU capabilities in terms of designers and things like that. Lots of test and enterprise features as well. But we're not going to talk about any of that today. But that's a whole bunch of stuff that is coming. Instead, we're going to talk about a whole bunch of other great stuff that's coming that hopefully you like even more than this, that you can take advantage of. One thing that I do want to make a point on, which is there's lots of stuff that I'm not talking about. There's a lot of stuff I am talking about that's new, that's improved, that you can take advantage of. One of the themes that hopefully you'll see a little bit, though, throughout this talk, which is most of the features I'm going to be showing aren't radically new from a programming model concept. In other words, they're not revolutionary new things that you're going to have to spend months of time learning in order to take advantage of. There's lots and lots of features that are coming, lots of improvements. The nice thing about a lot of these features is that they're very easy for you to immediately take advantage of and get benefit around. So they don't replace things you already know. They don't require massively rewriting your code base in order to take advantage of. Instead, just lots of improvements you can immediately apply, hopefully make your lives a lot easier from a development perspective. So with that, let's go talk about some of the stuff I am going to talk about. First thing I want to talk a little bit about is the new Visual Studio 2010 IDE. So one of the things you'll notice is there's a slightly new look. We're still finalizing the exact color scheme and things like that with Visual Studio 2005. Visual Studio 2010, I don't know why I keep calling it 2005. So there's a slightly new look. What's also radically different is the way it's been implemented. It's now built on top of WPF. That gives us a ton of flexibility, a ton of capability. And it's allowed us to add a whole bunch of new features that I'll be demoing in a second that you can take advantage of. It also means it's super extensible, so that anyone, whether it's us, you, or a third-party plugin provider, can now build extensions that integrate inside Visual Studio and provide lots of value, both in the code editor as well as the overall IDE. And so we kind of see this new architecture work that we've done as enabling a whole bunch of new scenarios and capabilities going forward for everyone to take advantage of. With that, I thought, let's actually do some demos to actually show some of this off. How many people here have multiple monitors at work? Number of people. If you've used multiple monitor support in Visual Studio before, you probably know it's very easy to take advantage of. You just launch Visual Studio twice. That was a joke. But Visual Studio 2010, you'll notice here you can take anything now. For example, here's some tabs. I can click a tab, and you can now drag the code window outside, and you can now run it on any monitor you want. And so you can do this for code window. You can do this for if you want to do the Solution Explorer. I unfortunately don't have two monitors here, but imagine this was a second monitor. As you can see, it's pretty easy to basically separate. At any point you want to redock, just basically drag it back into the window and reset like that. So now you can basically get multi-monitor support pretty easily and take advantage of the extra hardware that a lot of you, it looks like, already have. One thing I'm showing here is actually the ASP.NET MVC source project. Which is a reasonably sized C# project. Available here. You can download the source from our website if you want to open and edit it directly. What I thought is actually spend a little bit of time showing off some of the other new capabilities that are provided as part of the IDE and as part of the text editor. How many times do people spend looking at code? A lot of times. In fact, if you actually count up, there's a way you can opt in, and we actually do kind of look at kind of usage data inside Visual Studio. And one of the things that's interesting is people actually spend significantly more time looking at code, reviewing code, trying to understand code than they actually do spending writing code. And so one of the things that we did in this release is not only focused on writing code, but also added a whole bunch of new capabilities around looking at code and helping you understand your code, be able to find the code, refactor your code, and overall analyze it. So let's show off a few of those features here. How many times have you ever looked at a method and you see some parameters and you're trying to figure out where all those parameters are used? One person does. Good. What you can do now is basically highlight any symbol inside a method or inside a class And you'll notice we'll actually now highlight all the places that it's being used inside the editor, or inside that method. So fairly simple, fairly small, but adds kind of a little bit of a nice touch. Everyone here, I'm sure, uses IntelliSense. So we'll do this dot, and you can see, okay. Let's say I want to do get parameter values, this dot. One of the things that's kind of annoying is I got to type get, and I got to do parameter, and I got to do, oops, there's two ones, so I got to spell it out or use the key or whatever. One of the things, the subtle, but again, nice improvement in the editor here is you no longer have to actually start with the method name. We could actually say, let's just do value. And notice we automatically now do regular expression-based filtering so that you can actually jump to whatever you want. Or if, let's say, it starts with get, you can basically filter immediately that way. So provides, again, a nice shortcut so you can start typing, immediately filter what you're based on, and away you go. Because our methods and types in .NET are camel cased, we can actually separate out the different words inside a method. And so one of the other things you can do is I can just type, for example, get PV, and it'll filter based on all the methods that start with a get, have a print, a P word, and then have a V word. Again, as a quick way, you can basically filter, do camel casing. You know, these types of little productivity hints kind of add up a little bit along the way. Ever try to figure out where a class is or where, oops, a method or someone else's? how I did that. trying to figure out how, it's still around my head but in my hand. Anyway, you ever trying to find something inside your project, inside your solution? Probably a lot of people use find all in files and you search for something, and you know, that's one sort of brute force way you can search for something. We now have a control shift key, which launches to what we call quick search. And so if I wanted to search for our controller, I can do that. It basically gives me in real time a listing of all the places that controller or anything related to controller in terms of a symbol or a class is being used inside my project. I can jump to controller base and we immediately go to that. Again, likewise, if I know there's a cache object, just type cache, and not only will it show me things that start with cache, but it will actually show me all the keywords and symbols inside my project that have the word cache in it. Again, if you know camel casing, I could say ACT, and that will filter based on camel casing or the start method, and away you go. So a very quick search, always kept in real time, allows you to quickly navigate back and forth in your projects pretty quickly anywhere you want. Is it dockable, you said?
Yeah.
I don't know. Let's see. Looks like, well, you can drag it into a different screen. So, yeah. Ever looked at a piece of code and wondered what's calling this? So, for example, there's a render view method inside the view page class right here. And you're trying to think, oh, do I want to rechange it, or where could this parameter be passed in from? Again, you can use search today and try to find it. That's a fairly brute force way. Or with VS 2010, you can now just click on a method or on a property, right click, and we now have a new thing called view call hierarchy. What this is going to show me is all the places in my code base that call into this method. And so let's actually zoom in there. And you can basically see, okay, this thing is called to from render view and restore content type. I can actually drill in and see, well, who calls that? It's called in there. And basically then, you know, who calls that? So you can basically navigate around. If you want to jump to the source, just double click. And since I'm zoomed in, you can't see, but it basically just immediately jumped to that location above me. I can also see what's being called from this method and actually navigate and traverse that way as well. And so, again, very quickly navigate throughout your source code, see all of the different relationships about how things are being used, how they're being called, and take advantage of it. You can also then save any of these particular call hierarchies in a list, so you can keep track of them. You can see, so if I, for example, said, hey, where is this guy being used. Likewise, I can search for it there. And again, you can see down here, I now have my previous search and my next search. I can get rid of them if I wanted to. But it makes, again, make it very easy for you to navigate around your project, quickly see the relationships between your code, and hopefully as a result, better be able to organize, structure your code, and figure out what's going on there. Some other little nifty features in the editor while we're at it. Ever said, hey, I want to make these things public, or you want to rename something on multiple lines? And today, what I often do is I type public, I copy, paste, copy, paste, copy, paste. There's a new support now in VS 2010. Hold down the Alt key, and you can now do hierarchical selection across multiple things and change them all at once. And so you can do this for variable naming. You can do this for type naming. If you want to switch between Hungarian and non-Hungarian naming notation, you can line up all the little asterisks or not and quickly change them in one go. So nice little simple fix there. How many people are using test-driven development? Cool. Okay, well, we're going to talk about Model View Controller and how to use it in more depth in the second talk. But I thought I'd show one last editor change that we think is pretty big. It's useful not only for ASP.NET and MVC, but anytime you're doing any kind of test-driven development-based workflow. And so to do that, let's add a new class to this project. What kind of class do you want to add to it? The High Scott class. Okay. Let's build it as a controller. And let's do it in a true TDD fashion. So test-driven development, so we're going to... the idea behind test-driven development, I'll talk about it more in the second talk, is rather than implement your functionality and then write a unit test against it, you actually write a unit test before you implement the functionality. You have the unit test fail, then you implement the functionality, and then you have the unit test pass. And so let's go ahead and implement the High Scott controller in a TDD fashion real quick, just to show off some of these editor features. So to do this, I'm not going to implement the High Scott controller myself. Instead, I'm going to create a new basic unit test, and I'm going to call it the High Scott controller test. Creates a new unit test for me, and I'm going to basically say, what kind of controller method do you want to have on this?
Say hello.
Okay. So we're going to basically say, verify the say hello action, which will be a method we're going to add on this controller, renders a view. So we're going to make it basically a descriptive test method. So when it fails, I can figure out exactly what's going on. And then we're going to go ahead and implement a test, which is going to test this controller that doesn't exist. You might say, that seems a little weird. How can I write code against something that doesn't exist? Well, let's try it. So I could say, Scott, we're going to call it the High Scott. One of the things you're going to notice here is IntelliSense is kind of getting in the way. So this is the standard IntelliSense kind of approach that we've had in the past where it's trying to help me. It's trying to say, there is a class called High Scott controller test out there. Don't you want to use it? I say, well, I don't really want to use it. I'm just going to say High Scott controller, space, ooh, and just it kindly completed it for me, even though I didn't want to use it. So oftentimes this type of IntelliSense completion is great when I'm working with an object that exists. Right now I'm working with a class that doesn't exist. So what we have now in VS 2010 is a way that you can switch IntelliSense from kind of aggressive completion mode like it is today to something we call consume first mode. What that means is I can write against classes and types and methods that don't yet exist, and the IntelliSense engine won't get in the way. And I basically use Control Alt Space in order to toggle between those two different modes. And so what I'll write now is I'm going to say, Hi, Scott Controller. Hit space. Notice it didn't complete for me. I'm going to say controller equals new high. You'll notice even though this class doesn't exist, VS has inferred that I'm working against a High Scott controller type, and so it does give me IntelliSense completion for it, even though, again, this class doesn't exist yet. I'm going to basically then say, let's call a method on this. Controller dot, what was it again we're going to method call?
Say hello.
Say hello indeed. Okay, so we're going to call this method called say hello. And I'm going to say this is going to return a view result, which is a MVC type. And then I'm going to write a test, is not null. And I'm going to basically say, should have returned a view. So it's a simple test. I'm basically creating the controller class, calling a method on it, and I'm asserting that the method returned the right results. Great. Let's compile. Oh, I'm getting an error. And the reason I'm getting an error is because there is no such thing as a high-scout controller, and there is no such thing as a say hello method. But I was able to, by switching into this IntelliSense mode, write it still. VS is helping me. It's not hurting me. Let's now implement this. Rather than have to go create a class, I can actually just hover over it, control dot, or just right click, and I can basically say, hey, do I want to generate this class? I do. Let's create it inside my MVC project. I'm going to call it the high controller method. I'm going to make it public. Hit OK. Compile now. Ooh, my controller class exists, but say hello doesn't. Hey, let's go ahead and implement this. Basically now I'm compiling clean. And you'll see VS has built the class for me automatically based on my usage. I can right click. I can run my tests. This is going to launch the test harness. It's going to fail, and that's because I haven't actually implemented it, but this is in TrueDD fashion. Wrote it, got a compile error, fixed the compile error, ran the test. Test failed. Now I'm going to go ahead and implement the test. And so to do that, I can go in here. I can drive from controller class. It's an MVC guy. I can say, hey, we're going to return view result. And we'll say return view. Fairly simple little thing here. Right click, rerun my tests. Now my test passed. So it's basically a simple test-driven development workflow. Create a test, implements functionality in a class that doesn't exist. Quickly implement the functionality with the tool. Run the test, see it fail. Go in and actually implement the functionality. And you can get into a very nice TDD workflow here. The benefit of writing your test first, in case you're wondering why in the world you do this, is the idea is you start to think about the thing you're about to implement. If you start writing tests against the functionality, you hopefully guarantee that you think about the edge cases. If you have a test that fails, if this thing passed, then we know there's something weird and wrong with our test. But basically, this allows us to build up tests. And when I want to switch back into the normal IntelliSense mode, just hit Control-Alt-Space again. And now I'm back in standard IntelliSense mode, and I can continue writing code as usual. Sort of simple way to do kind of this consume-first-based model to work against things. And if you're interested in test-driven development, should be a big time-saver and productivity win. So let's look at a couple other demos here. How many people here are doing ASP.NET development? Great, lots of people. Let's talk about some other kind of IDE improvements and overall editor improvements that we're doing that you can take advantage of. How many people love typing run it equals server on elements? Yeah, it's sort of a lot of typing if you're working in source view mode. Common thing people often ask is, how can I do more with fewer keystrokes? So you saw some of that from a code editing perspective. Let's look at some of these from an ASP.NET perspective, what you can do. How many people ever implemented a list view control in ASP.NET? So you have list view, typically have an item template, you have a layout template, you have data binding expressions. Typing that by hand probably takes a minute or two. We have new support for something called snippets. And so if I wanted to implement a list view now, I could type, there's a snippet, tab, tab, and I now have a list view implemented with the stub implementation that I can go take advantage of. And so basically we have snippets for JavaScript, for markup, for styles, for HTML elements, everything. So if I want to, for example, implement a text box with a required field validator, I could type TB in order to get a text box. If I wanted to add a required field validator, I could select that, tab, tab, name required, or whatever I want to do, tab, and I could basically, default to naming it the same value that my previous control was, in this case, text box 1. If I wanted to change it, I could change it as well. We basically have over 200 various markup snippets built in. Again, it works for controls. I could type anchor AA for static HTML, and I can say page.aspx. Click here to go there. If you wanted to do inline styles, you could do style. It'll automatically set up that text equals text CSS element. If you want to do JavaScript, you could do script. Again, it'll automatically code complete text for you. If you're writing JavaScript, let's say in a library, say using ASP.NET Ajax, likewise, I could say control, tab, tab. This basically wires up all of the JavaScript kind of framework for doing controls and doing class encapsulation. I could say scottq.ui. Notice it updates as I'm changing those variables, and I could call this the say hello control. Updates, now I can just write my code. So very quick ways that I can take advantage of snippets in my VB, C Sharp, JavaScript, HTML, CSS, pretty much everywhere you can now use snippets. You can write your own custom snippets. You can share those snippets across teams, and you can basically download snippets from galleries. And lots of nice, small, simple things that can improve productivity. Yeah, question?
Do you support jQuery as well for
snippets? Yeah, so the question is, do we support jQuery as well for snippets? Yep, we support jQuery, you can plug in your own. A little bit later on, I'll show Ajax IntelliSense and JavaScript improvements around the editor, and we'll do some jQuery scenarios around IntelliSense as well there. In addition, you can do Yahoo UI, you can do prototype, you can do any type of JavaScript snippets that you want. How many people have ever written an app with a bug in it? I have myself, but I've heard of people that have. So let's actually look at a simple app here. This is a really simple, very simple app. Enter a number, divide by a number, it spits out a result. So it's basically a simple calculator that only does division. Implemented in a very simple way. Back to a very naive, dumb way, but basically I have a method, a button click event handler, calls this do division method, away it goes, divides it, sticks out the message, super basic, super simple. You'll notice there's a bug, divide by zero, and I get no error message, and I also get no result. And you probably guess this is probably a division by zero issue, but imagine it was slightly more complex. Now, today, with Visual Studio, hit F5, obviously, to run this, I can attach the debugger when I'm doing this. And to try things out, I can say 45.9, run it. Here I am broken in the debugger. I can see the state of what's happened after this event handler, but oops, I didn't actually set my breakpoint earlier, and so that I can't actually see exactly what happened. One of the things that we've added in VS 2010 is also this thing called debug history now. It shows up. And what this shows you is not only your current debugger state as it is, but what this lets you do is actually see what are the sequence of events that led up to that. As you can see, ASP.NET lifecycle events are now included as part of that. Any exceptions, any registry access, any file I/O access is automatically captured as part of that debug history and included as part of your lifetime. So you can see, hey, the user actually clicked the divide button, post back raise event has happened. You have the ASP.NET source online. This will actually show you our source in the window as you do it. What we also now support is the ability to switch the debugger into a mode that allows you to actually step back in time while you're debugging. So let me show you what that looks like. You go to Tools, Options. There's a new thing called Historical Debugging. I can basically say collect not only the events, but also diagnostics and call information. Hit F5, so we're rerunning this again, 45 divided by 0, hit divide here. What you'll see is now in this history window, not only is it actually capturing the breakpoint, but it's also showing me the exception that I swallowed within my own code. And so I can actually drill back to that location. So for example, let's actually drill up there. As you can see, I'm now stepping back in time and actually maintaining call stack, auto, and variable history. So effectively, I'm debugging backwards instead of forwards. And you'll notice here I can even actually now step back as well as step forward within the debugger, capturing my variable state, again, in both directions at any point in time. I can see exactly what the variable state of my machine is, which is a first and something we've never done before. I don't think anyone else does either. What's even better is you can actually load up into the debugger now dump state from a customer where if they've actually crashed their app or run into a problem on their machine, they can actually dump it out to a file, send it to you. You open up the project, load the dump state, and we'll actually put the debugger in that location of where it was on their machine, broken in the source code at that location. You can also now step forward and back effectively in their virtual machine, so to speak, and actually debug throughout all of that. And if you're using some of our test tools in the enterprise suite, we make it really easy. So even if someone's doing manual testing of an app, they can quickly save that debug information, pass it off to the developer, they can load it into the IDE, and step through it backwards and forwards. So big improvements there from a debugging perspective. Questions on that?
What would you be waiting for when you start with WPF and everything?
Yeah, you can basically use that debug dump information for WinForms, WPF, anything. It's particularly useful for client apps. Sometimes with server apps, you can at least have diagnostic information to capture some stuff within your own code. Often with client apps, the user just says, hey, I clicked something and it crashed. Which is not terribly useful. Now you can basically capture that information, load it up, and away you go. One of the things I'm not going to be talking about today is some of the new enterprise testing tools that are shipping as part of ES 2010. Included as part of that is a manual testing tool that you can use that allows you to view the test plans and actually run through the test plans and integrates as part of that dump trace information. And so if the user, as they're doing the manual testing, ever runs into an issue, it'll save the dump state, allow you to upload and attach it to the bug, and then a developer can just load it up directly inside ES, directly out of TFS. So lots of improvements there, hopefully some cool things to take advantage of. So anyways, that was a quick flavor of a few IDE features. Let's talk a little bit now about versioning, multi-targeting, and then drill into some of the web-specific stuff. So .NET 4 is a new release. And it includes a new CLR. And so this is somewhat significant in that we haven't actually released a new version string of the CLR since .NET 2 back in 2005. .NET 3, .NET 3.5 were actually new framework libraries but ran on top of the V2 CLR. And so that's why if you've ever used like the ASP.NET config tool or ever looked at the version string, for your .NET 3.5 apps, you might have wondered, why is it V2? That's basically because it's still based on the V2 Coming runtime engine and just simply new libraries. With .NET 4, we now include a new CLR, and so you can see the new version string in any kind of version drop-down inside IIS or if you're configuring the client tool. That version of the CLR is side-by-side compatible with the V2 and the V1.1 and V1.0 versions, which means that you can install them on the same machine. Apps can be written to still run using V2, or they can take advantage of the new V4 CLR and run at the same time. The other thing that we've done with version 4 is we now run side-by-side inside the same process. So you can actually have, for example, a Windows Forms app, and you can load the version 2 CLR and the version 4 CLR in the same process and have some components use some and some use the other. And that's generally, I wouldn't recommend that for your own custom app, but if you're building things like extensions for Office, now you no longer have to worry if someone loaded a component for Office that was built against V2 and then loads your component that's built against V4, they'll now work the same even though they're in the same process running together. VS 2010 then supports multi-targeting for both .NET 2, 3, 3.5, and 4. So you can basically use VS, target any of those different versions, get full IntelliSense debugging, and all the features that I just showed, with the exception of the backwards debugging, which is only for V4, all the other editor features and IDE features I just showed will work when you're opening your .NET 2, .NET 3, or .NET 3.5 projects just fine. So with that, let's show some demos. So let's close this. You'll notice basically when you file a new project that in the drop-down at the top, we now let you pick which version of the .NET framework you want to run against, similar to what we did in VS 2008. So here I'm just going to create a .NET 3.5 ASP.NET application. You'll notice in the web.config file, you have the standard stuff that we add into that config file. If I am using IntelliSense, so for example, let's say I do ASP.NET grid view. For IntelliSense, as well as, say, the property grid, we can just pull up here and you'll notice there's a CSS class, but there's no other properties that start with letter C. We'll see that in a second. And then if I actually, say if I went to my code behind here, ID equals grid 1, inside my IntelliSense, if I say grid 1 dot, there's a client ID property, a CSS class property, but no other properties that start with the letter C. This is significant because the way our multi-targeting work is now working, we're actually giving you IntelliSense, giving you property grid and designer support based on the actual properties that shipped in that version of the framework that you're targeting. With 2008, we called it fake multi-targeting in that we filtered items and we did a bunch of filtering, but at the end of the day, because we're working directly against the libraries, we'd still end up surfacing properties and object model differences for the latest version that was installed in your machine instead of the version you're targeting. Now we have kind of much more accurate IntelliSense. And if you upgrade your project, which you can do by pulling up the properties, choosing .NET 4, this will basically reload your app. Inside the property grid now, you'll notice that in the C category, alphabetically. There's now a couple of additional properties, client ID mode, client ID row suffix, some new ASP.NET properties that are in control, which we'll talk about in a little bit. And likewise, when you go to IntelliSense now, you'll see all the new .NET 4.0 properties showing up as well. Benefit here is you're going to get IntelliSense, you're going to get property support only against the properties you're supposed to get, so much more accurate, much more informative. Going forward, even for things like service packs, we can now ship what we call reference assemblies that will give you IntelliSense. So if we ever introduce a new feature or capability inside a service pack, we can now make sure that the IntelliSense engine clearly tells you whether or not it's running, you know, it's going to be supported in the version of .NET that you're targeting. Any questions on that? Good question. So the question is for IntelliSense and those options, are you currently differentiating between .NET 2 and .NET 2 with an SP? We're not right now in the assemblies that we're shipping. Instead, we basically differentiate by major version, and then we have a server core profile for .NET 3.5. The main reason we're doing that is all the service packs are right now critical updates on Windows Update, and so when we ship, we basically think most systems out there will already have it installed. Except if it's an unpatched system, which is probably has bigger problems. But going forward, that is something that we're planning on doing for new service packs. We'll do if there are any significant new feature additions, we'll add it as part of that. Good question. So one other thing, when I updated the project here, which we'll look at in just a second, is if I go into the config file, you'll notice it's a lot cleaner. In fact, the only stuff that's there is actually the generic or some of the text stuff that was there before. But all those assemblies were basically ripped out, and all that extra config information was also ripped out as well. That's part of a general theme that we're trying to do with ASP.NET 4, which is just to simplify things, try to keep things, make you know, common things simple. Get rid of some of the crud that we surface in various places around the product and try to keep a simple experience throughout it. And hopefully you'll see in these next couple demos and segments that I'll talk about that as kind of a common theme in terms of sort of cleanliness, simplicity, and getting out of your way. And so you'll notice if you file a new project now and create an ASP.NET 4.0 project, there's both an empty project template and a new application template project, which we'll look at. We create the empty project template, go to web.config. That is your entire web.config. We're actually seeing, can we get rid of one or two of those as well? But again, it's clean, it's simple. We're not adding much stuff in your face, trying to keep it nice and easy. The other project template that's common for if you're building an ASP.NET web app is this new one right here, ASP.NET web application. Instead of an empty project, this creates a project template with a couple of default things. Let's just run it, you can see. What we're trying to do is basically, instead of starting you with a blank form, actually start you with an application that has a home page, an about page, a login page, as well as a registration page for security, all implemented on the box that you can take advantage of, all using kind of a common master page look and feel, so it's easy to customize, all using CSS, and we even preload in your scripts directory jQuery, and then you can get ASP.NET AJAX out of the script manager control that's built into ASP.NET as well. And so very quickly, very easy way, create a project, get a bunch of functionality, and have kind of a basic scaffold that you can start using as you're building your app. The new project dialog inside VS also now allows you to search. So you can search an online gallery that we provide. I don't think it's running right now. Yeah, we don't currently have anything in the gallery because we haven't shipped yet. But basically, it's going to allow you to upload templates. So we're going to put periodic project templates. You can also create your own templates. And the community can create their templates, post it into the gallery. We'll do ratings, security certs on it. And that way, you can basically download different types of projects, a CMS project, a commerce project, and use that as an easy way to get started as you're building new solutions. Maybe we'll do it using web forms today. Okay, number of people. Let's talk about some of the common complaints people have around doing web forms today. A couple of things that people often complain about with web forms is, hey, I want to have control over my HTML. How can you kind of get out of my way and give me the ability to have kind of clean, accessible, XHTML compliant HTML that I can easily write JavaScript against and I can easily style and use CSS against. And so a couple of big things that we're doing with ASP.NET V4 is giving you that ability. So you can now, for example, control the client IDs and all the controls that you use. So for example, there's a new client ID mode property that you can say set it at the web.config file, you can set it at the page level, you can set it at the individual control level. And I could say, set it in what's called static mode. And so if you say ASP text box ID equals text box 1, the client ID that's output on the client will be text box 1. And so you no longer have to play tricks in order to fish out the control or figure out what the ID is on the client side. You can now completely control it. We also then have a mode called predictable, which allows you to kind of concatenate IDs together to avoid collisions. Then we have the auto, which is what we had before with previous versions of ASP.NET. And then we have the default, which is called inherit, which basically just picks up whatever setting is set at the most parent level. So now complete control over your IDs. We also now have CSS-based rendering support. This removes the need to use the CSS adapters that we've shipped with ASP.NET in the past. Instead, controls now by default generate use CSS for things like styles. And basically do support non-table-based HTML rendering. So for example, if I had a menu like I do at the bottom here, this instead of generating a table like it does today, now just generates a standard ULLI list that is completely stylable using something like CSS Zen Garden. And likewise for controls like form view or grid view or details view, which typically is table-based. There's now also a render table property that you can set, which will basically turn off rendering the outer table, at which point you can stick it inside any type of content you want. So if you want to have a completely tableless-based UI, now easy to do and take advantage of inside here. We're also then adding much better view state management support. There's another common complaint with ASP.NET. Specifically, there's a new view state mode property that you can set on controls. By default with ASP.NET today, if you turn off view state at the page level, no control within the page can use view state. Using this new view state mode property, you can actually turn off view state at the app level or the page level, and then just turn it on the individual controls within a page that you need it on. Allows to have much smaller amounts of view state. Also means that you can now turn it off globally at the application level and only turn it on when necessary so that you don't accidentally leave view state on within the application and bloat your page size unnecessarily. We're also making a lot of improvements to the HTML designer. In particular, we're adding W3C CSS 2.1 support. So if you use standard selectors inside the standard page, selectors inside any of your CSS or any of your markup, the designer will now render it correctly in WYSIWYG mode. So specifically, we have all these new attribute accessories that we support, all these new lang pseudo classes that we support, some of which I actually don't know what they do, but they're cool. First child pseudo inherent values, transparent values, as well as the correct interpolation of invalid selectors. All those things are now supported. We're now ACID compliant inside our WYSIWYG designer. So you'll actually see kind of reflected inside the designer, hopefully what you'll see inside the browser as well. How many people, though, don't use Design View? Yeah, we hear that from a lot of people say, hey, I don't use Design View. Thank you for keeping making it better. But what I'd really like is a button to turn it off. This is actually a lot of people have asked for it. So we're giving you a button to turn it off. So you can now go to Tools Options and actually turn off the designer entirely. We're also then creating a new code-optimized web profile. So you'll see in Beta 2, we'll ask you, do you want the web development profile or the web development code-optimized profile? You can select either one, and you can always change it at a later point. This is what the default profile looks like. We have actually removed a lot of the tool windows, the drop-downs, and line numbers, so it's a little bit less like a 747 cockpit, and you also see a lot more of your code. But if you switch into the code-optimized profile, you'll see an even more reduced IDE experience. You'll notice that there's no longer a design split source view. Instead, you're always in source view when you're inside an ASPX or HTML file. We no longer have any of the tab windows, property window, or toolbox. Instead, those are hidden as well. Basically, the goal being to give you maximum screen real estate and really focus on the code editing experience and making sure that the tool kind of gets out of your way in order to do that. Again, all of these options are available not only through the profile but through your tools options. So if you're like, hey, I kind of like the designer, but I'd rather not have one of the other features, just go into tools options and you can individually select or turn on any of the features depending on how you want to work with it. Other common asks that people have. How many people are using ASP.NET MVC? Okay, a number of people are. One of the things that we introduced with ASP.NET MVC is a URL routing engine that basically allows you to easily expose clean, logical URLs from within your website. And so instead of saying products.aspx ?category equals beverages, you can just say /product/beverages or /product/condiments, which gives you kind of nice SEO optimization and make you feel cool in terms of how your URLs are exposed in your website, which is an important thing, the feeling cool part. With 3.5SP1, we introduced this routing engine. It was primarily used for MVC as well as for a few of our dynamic data scenarios. What we're doing in .NET 4 is making it easy for you to expose SEO-friendly URL routing to all types of ASP.NET apps, including web forms-based apps. So, for example, let's actually just walk through a simple scenario here. I have a products page that I'm loading. My database start up. There we go. My database is started now. And I can say products.aspx ?, category equals beverages, and display a list of beverages. And I could say condiments. and display a different list of comments. Not exactly the prettiest page, but you get the idea. The downside right now is, if you look at how I'm implementing this, is I basically am using a query string as part of the URL. And instead, what I want to do is actually take advantage of kind of a more logical URL structure for my application. Good news is, doing this is pretty easy. All I need to do is go into my global.sax file. If you're familiar with ASP.NET MVC, you know that there's a route table that routes that you map routes to, and you can map routes to controllers and controller actions. We now have a new extension method called mapPageRoute. And what that now lets you do is you can name a route. So in this case, we'll just call it the product route, or I could just say product browse if I wanted to give it a more descriptive name. And then basically I'm saying map any URLs that start with products and then have a category parameter to the products.aspx page that's in my project. I can optionally add a fourth parameter, which is default values to specify for category in the event that they're not populated within that URL. And I could also add constraints, so if I want to say the category has to be a string with no letters, I could add a regular expression to restrict it there as well. This is now going to allow me to map things. I can then go into my products page. Right now I have some link code, which is going into Northwind context, grabbing all the products and binding to my list, and I'm basically pulling the category out of the request query string in order to display the products. If I want to change that, I can. And so I can actually just say page.route data.values. Category as string. And now, when I go back here, I can now say lose the ASPX slash beverages. And away it works. And so now I have SEO friendly, Web 2.0 friendly hierarchical URL routing. So I can do continents as well. And I can basically switch on any of those super easily, very easy to route those parameters in there. I can also have a combination of MVC controllers and web form pages now in the same project. Both are using the same routing engine. I can integrate both of those as part of that experience. And if I want to, I can still use postback within this page and still take advantage of the SEO benefits I get with that. So, any questions on routing?
Yes.
Yeah.
Hi,
good question. So the question here is the beverages in the query string collection? The answer is no. So basically the way the routing system's working is the routing engine gets first dibs at the thing, and then basically it's routing it to there. So instead of doing URL rewriting, which is what people typically do today, where you're kind of faking it out, instead you're actually working with the raw URL directly. The benefit with this is, for example, if you're doing postback or you're doing something inside the page, you're not going to get the rewritten URL. You're going to get the actual URL the user's seeing output inside your page. So it's much more accurate. You can also, there's a get route URL helper method that's on the page. So if you want to look up what a route URL looks like for, say, something in particular, you can basically look that up as well. So if you're creating, you'll see this a little bit later on when we're doing some data scenarios, and I want to link to other pages. You can tie into the routing system from within your web forms as well. And again, it's the same routing engine we use for MVC, so you can have a nice combination of web forms as well as controller pages if you'd like within your application. How many people build publicly facing sites? Oh, question there.
Yeah, just wondering if that will also work in IIS6.
Ah, or is it just IIS6? Good question. The question is, will that work in IIS6 or does it only work with IIS7? That will work in IIS6. Now, if you want to do extensionless-based URLs, like I did there with products slash beverages, then you need to install an ISAPI filter, which will basically parse out, or you map all requests to ASP.NET, which you can do, the same way that you do it with ASP.NET MVC today, in which case you can get the extensionless. If you don't want to configure anything on your IIS box, then you still need to have ASPX URLs. But you can do products.aspx slash beverages as opposed to question mark, which from a search engine perspective gives you the same SEO benefits. A good question. How many people building publicly facing sites today? Cool. How many people spend a lot of time optimizing for SEO? How many people know that they should be optimizing for SEO but don't? Well, anyone that didn't raise their hand in the second question really should have raised their hand in the third. SEO is important because it can dramatically improve your traffic if you have an externally facing site. One of the things that we're trying to do with ASP.NET 4 is make it a lot easier to build great SEO-based applications. So I showed you the URL routing. That's one tip you can take advantage of. And we'll talk a little bit of, and you might ask, why does that really matter? For two things. One is certain search engines sometimes rate URLs higher than query string values. The other thing you'll see in a little bit that a lot of people run into is, and don't realize, is that search engines are case sensitive and they're order sensitive often when it comes to query string. So if I say category equals name and page equals one, that is going to be ranked differently than page equals one and category equals beverages. And so sometimes you can mistakenly get the query strings wrong, whereas if you canonicalize it inside the URL, it's harder to get wrong because it just won't work if you get it wrong. Other things that we're doing in terms of SEO improvements with ASP.NET 4, we have a new meta API that's available on pages, so you can actually programmatically set the description and keywords. This is great for master page scenarios where you can't easily reach up and poke the master page where you want to set this in the head. We also have new response.redirect APIs so that you can redirect to permanent links as well as redirect to routes easily within your application. We also then have a tool that was shipped a couple months ago called the IIS SEO Toolkit. How many people have used this? A few people have. A lot of people haven't, which is cool and convenient because I'm going to demo it. So if you haven't used this tool, you basically install it. It shows up inside the IIS manager. It does not require you to have IIS 7 on the server. So if you have Vista or you have Win 7, you can basically install it on the client and point to a remote server. It can be an IIS 6 server. It can be an IIS 5 server, even be an Apache server. There's no requirement to have IIS on the server side. Once the client tool is installed, though, this admin tool will show up a new section called SEO optimization at the bottom. Basically the way it works when you launch it is there's a site analysis tool. By default, it's blank. And you can say new analysis in order to create an SEO scan against a remote server. And so I'm going to call this Scott's site as the name. I can point to any URL. So I'm going to say go to scottgreer.com, which is my site. Let me just actually make sure it's running. People have been threatening to move me to a new server. Oh, good, but not today. So it's running. I can basically say, how many links do I want to chase on this site? I'm going to say 200. I hope that the network's fast. And I can basically say, do I want to follow links within the site as well? And basically when I do this, it's going to cause this tool to pretend it's a search engine, pretend it's Google or Bing, and basically crawl my site looking for SEO issues. Hit OK. And I'm now basically remotely accessing the site. I'm following all the links, finding all the different URLs on my site, and generating a report against it. Once it's done, basically found 425 SEO violations on my site. What's pathetic about this, besides the fact that I actually wrote my own site and had all these issues, which I might point out, I wrote my site a long time ago. 6 years ago, is my site is really basic. there's some nice pictures and stuff, but I don't actually have that much functionality. And so when I first saw it, I had 425 violations. I thought, that can't possibly be true. How could the site that has 6 ASPX pages, possibly have 425 violations? Well, turns out I do. And the great thing about the report tool is it'll actually tell you what all those violations are. So it will tell you just how stupid you are. So some of them are kind of basic, like my image tag doesn't actually have an alt attribute, which sounds, it'll actually tell me where exactly in my text and URL that alt attribute is, which sounds like, hey, why do I care? And then you realize, well, I'm actually displaying pictures of animals. There's no way for a search engine to know what the picture is. If I actually added the alt tab from the description, search engine would suddenly know that this was a picture of a lion, and I'd get more traffic. Descriptions missing from all of my pages. And so you can see basically, I don't have a meta name equals description attribute. That new API in ASP.NET 4 makes it really easy for me to add. Again, this would basically enable search engines to get a much better view of what this is. Page contains unnecessary redirects. Let me say, what does that mean? Well, it turns out inside my app, inside my blog, instead, when you click the blog tab, I was just sort of silly because I had a blog ASPX file that was previously reading the RSS. I just naively implemented response.redirect inside that page and redirected it to my real blog, which is weblog.ASP.NET/specgoo. What the search engine has figured out is, hey, you know what? By doing that, search engine, Google and Bing, aren't actually going to follow the redirect. They're just going to simply see it redirects. And because I didn't return back a permanent redirect, it won't actually follow the redirect linked to it. And so effectively, I just lost search engine traffic and search engine relevancy within my site. If I use the new response.redirect permanent, I'd fix that, or I could just use a client-side redirect, in which case I'd get there. My title begins with a brand name. What the heck does that mean? Well, it turns out that I actually use Scott Goo all over the place, because apparently I'm very egotistical. And so I say the Scott Goo site, and I say the Scott Goo about page, and the Scott Goo PhotoCat. Well, it basically says search engines are going to say, hey, you know, this is nonsense because you're duplicating the term all over the place, and rate my title a little bit lower on that page. I have invalid markup in a few places. And then this one is particularly interesting, which is a canonical thing. You remember I mentioned earlier about how search engines treat URLs, the order of parameters in query strings slightly differently? I would have sworn that I actually used my query strings consistently throughout the site, but it turns out in 53 different places I didn't. And it'll actually tell me places that I didn't, and in particular, useful, the exact URL or page that I can go to see where I'm actually inconsistently ordering the attributes. And then it'll actually tell me also any case where I'm using different casing. And so a few cases I use M, in some, or photo ID with a capital P. In some cases I use photo ID with a lowercase p. Or album ID. Anyway, album ID with a lowercase. And again, you can see search engines are going to think of these things as two separate URLs. So anyone that bookmarks the page, I'm basically automatically lowering my search relevancy by doing this. So anyway, simple report. There's lots of other mistaken things that I'm doing. Some of them are just warnings. Some of them are errors. Basically ran the report. As you saw, in less than 30 seconds, got a report. I can see all the errors. I can quickly fix it. And what's interesting is anyone that's basically run this tool on their site and actually fixed the URLs, actually told us, you know, a month later, my traffic on my site was up 20 or 30%. It does actually make a difference. In the past, it's been really hard to find all these things. Now it's really easy. It's a free tool. You can download it, run it against your sites today. And away you go. If you're wondering, how do I actually get this, as well as other things, you can go to this site, which is www.microsoft.com/web. We just recently redesigned it to look much prettier. There's something called the Web Platform Installer that you can click by installing there. I already have it installed. What the Web Platform Installer does is it will, when it runs, it'll actually scan your system and tell you what components are installed, and more importantly, give you a set of options for new components to install on your box. This works on servers, it works on clients, it'll work on XP, it works on Vista, it works on Win7, it works on 2003 and 2008. And so if I want to actually install web server components, I can click. Again, it shows me what's installed. If I want to enable forward cache proxy support, if I want WebDAV or FTP, I can do that. If I want Database Manager, I can do that. And somewhere in here, there's the SEO tool that you can take advantage of as well. Likewise, you can install SQL and various SQL drivers, as well as various tools, all directly within that tool. There's also then a Web Applications tab. You can install popular open source applications. So, for example, if I wanted .NET Nuke, I could install that. At any point, you can click Install. It'll show you all the different components you click to install. Just click I accept. It'll then download, install everything for you, configure it without you having to manually install each of the little components yourself. So anyway, that's free, available for download today, works with all your systems, and you can get the SEO tool through that.
Yep. If there are new updates from applications,
No, so the good thing about the web platform installer is it actually uses RSS in order to get its updates. And so first thing it does when it actually loads is it hits the RSS feed on our servers and downloads the new things. Little trick is if you want to use this either in a hosted environment or for your own enterprise, you can also now publish your own RSS feeds, and the tool will actually use those, and as long as you author using our manifest format, you can install components off of your own servers as well. And in the application gallery, things like Drupal, if you click that, it's actually, if you click download, you'll notice instead of coming from Microsoft, it's actually coming from the Drupal website. And you'll notice this component requires MySQL as well as PHP, and we'll actually install all of those components for you automatically on top of BIOS as well, just by hitting accept. So it's fairly easy, pulls components from all over the web, and anytime there's an update, the next time you run the tool, the RSS feed gets updated and away you go. So if you haven't already, definitely recommend running the SEO tool on your website. Let's talk a little bit about JavaScript. How many people are doing Ajax? JavaScript. Cool. A couple of improvements you get for free with Visual Studio 2010 when you're doing JavaScript development. One is faster updating, much better XML comment support, much richer library support, not just for ASP.NET Ajax and jQuery, but also things like Yahoo UI, Prototype, etc., and much better error tolerance. So I'm going to hit the B button. So faster IntelliSense. This is sort of some of the perf gains that we actually were in a previous build of VS, so this was a couple of months ago, so it's probably faster even now. But you can basically see the multiplier in terms of performance gains that you get going from VS 2008 to VS 2010 when updating IntelliSense. So more than 2x for ASP.NET Ajax, 5x for jQuery, 4x for Prototype, 6x for XJS. In general, what we see is anytime IntelliSense takes less than a second to update, the experience is pretty good. And so now across all the major libraries, except in XJS, although we're now better than I think anyone else from a tools perspective, we now have really good, fast, live IntelliSense that you can take advantage of immediately. We've always had, as part of our IntelliSense engine, the ability to create what these call XML documentation comments. What this means is you can basically have XML doc comments like this, and then when you reference a library and program against it, you'll notice that we now get this description that came from the XML doc comments automatically as part of IntelliSense. What you didn't get with Visual Studio 2008 is IntelliSense for those when you're actually within the same library or within the same JavaScript file. Instead, you just got the vanilla syntax. So you got it with that. You didn't get that with 2008. Now with 2010, you get the XML IntelliSense everywhere. So as you change stuff in the same file, you'll get automatic IntelliSense with help information updated inside that same file. Much more redundancy when you handle updates. One of the ways our IntelliSense engine works, because JavaScript is a very dynamic language, is we actually evaluate the JavaScript. With 2008, there were certain situations where basically you had an error in your JavaScript or you did something that caused us to error out. Now it's much more redundant and it handles a lot more scenarios. And I'll show demos of that in just a second. In fact, we'll show it now. So let's open this file up here. So let's start off with a statically named variable. And so we'll say var my var equals 1. I say my var dot. And one of the things you'll notice is I'm getting IntelliSense for integers. So this works same in 2008 today, because it's inferred that this my variable is a number. If I change this to hello Netherlands, my bar dot, you'll notice I'm getting IntelliSense now for this as a string. So again, this works the same as it did with 2008, just kind of showing how that works. Let's change this now. So instead of being a static name variable, let's make it a dynamic name variable. You might say, what does that mean? Well, I could say window my var equals hello Netherlands. Pretend I didn't do that. I could say my var there, and then I could actually say window my var dot and get IntelliSense against that. And so this is basically a way that I can actually use the window object inside the browser to basically reflect on a dynamic statically typed object and basically get kind of IntelliSense against that. You couldn't previously do that with VS 2008. Where this also then gets interesting is, so that's an example using the window object. Where this gets interesting is you can then do something like this, which is 4i equals 0, I less than 5, I plus plus. And I could say window my var plus I is equal to some message. And so what I have here is basically a for loop, which is dynamically creating variables and pushing into the name scope that are dynamically named with a variable type. You might think, wow, this seems really kind of weird. Actually, it turns out most JavaScript libraries use this at some point in various places. jQuery does it to reduce the file size, so they dynamically build functions on the fly. It causes lots of problems with IntelliSense engines because there's no way semantically to understand what this is doing. You have to actually evaluate it somewhere. The good news is we now evaluate it. And you now get IntelliSense against that. Even more impressive is we even know it's a string, and we're actually giving you IntelliSense against the string. This is really hard. but anyway, you can now take advantage of that. I hear a challenge. alert, please work. And so you can see basically, you see that the alert is not causing a problem. Even though we're evaluating this JavaScript, we know not to actually pop open an alert inside the IDE. if you want to make it even, go for broke here, we could throw some error. And hey, why don't we do this? Do what? Move it all. Well, first let me show you this working, and then let's try that. Notice it still works. You think you can break it. Hopefully you can't. Let's see.
What about a loop where we know your friends?
Yeah. Oh yeah, look at that.
What about defining it inside a closure?
Tell me how to write that. And I'll good news is you'll be able to try it out with the beta and let us know soon. But anyway, you do an infinite loop. We could do while. Still works there. So anyway, so this is an infinite loop. So all this is going to blow up in the browser, but it'll still get IntelliSense against it. the big places to use is libraries like jQuery, Yahoo UI, Prototype. They do take advantage of a lot of these tricks in order to reduce their file size and do things. And the great thing is now you can get IntelliSense against it without having to generate an IntelliSense optimized version of the file for us to parse. We think our JavaScript IntelliSense performance now is we believe best in breed of any tool out there. Let's look at a couple other scenarios. So if you're using ASP.NET, anyone using ASP.NET Ajax client-side library? You people are. You'll notice there's this concept we have of registering types and namespaces. It's because JavaScript doesn't natively have it, and this is common in lots of libraries. So here I'm registering Scott Guthrie, and you'll notice if I hit Scott, there's the namespace Guthrie, and so on. So you can basically, the past, you didn't get IntelliSense since 5BS 2008. We now recognize all of the MS Ajax style class and object model nomenclatures and support it there. And better yet, not only do we support it for our libraries, so Yahoo's. And so for prototype, Yahoo, jQuery, etc., they have their own way of declaring namespaces and types. And that didn't work. Oh, no, it did work, because the way they do it is they actually lead with Yahoo.Scott.Guthrie. You notice it works there as well. So again, we're kind of working with other libraries, integrating it, making sure you have a good IntelliSense experience across the board. We do fully support jQuery as well. Someone asked about jQuery. So this is a simple function. Here you're using some of the chained operators inside jQuery to do things. Notice we get chaining on top of our methods. So you could say effect and die. I think that's one of them. No, not there. Like after detonate, you can say die, which does the opposite of live. Anyway, don't really know what it does, but it sounds cool. I was seeing it last night. And when you're jet lagged, the die function sounds good. Anyway, you get chained IntelliSense, works with jQuery, works with Yahoo UI, works with MS Ajax. So improvements all there. Talk about other things that we're doing then inside our library. So as I mentioned, I saw earlier, shipping jQuery was part of our project templates. I think jQuery is a great framework. We're working hard to kind of make jQuery integrate well within ASP.NET, both web forms and MVC. We're also then continuing to invest heavily in our own Ajax stack. What we're trying to do with this is, you might say, why are you doing two? jQuery does a whole bunch of stuff that MS Ajax doesn't do, and ASP.NET Ajax is a whole bunch of stuff that jQuery doesn't do. And so what we're trying to do is make sure that they work together, and then you can mix and match between the different scenarios. With ASP.NET Ajax 4, we basically pulled apart the Ajax library into multiple separate files. And so you as a developer can pull in just the particular functionality you want in a nice, clean way. And there's a new library for basically coalescing the different, and I'll show in a second, coalescing any of the libraries you need and just downloading what your app actually uses. We're also then investing heavily in client-side templates, client-side controls, client-side data binding, and we're basically updating the Ajax control toolkit and allowing you to use that both through client-side script as well as the server-side control extenders that we support today. The client-side template stuff, I think, is particularly interesting and useful. If you're familiar with ASP.NET, you probably have seen controls here where I can basically do like server-side data binding where I have a list view and I have, say, I'm binding to a name value inside an item. What we now support with ASP.NET Ajax is the ability to do that client-side as well. And so I can basically stick a class attribute saying this is a template. I can then basically put HTML inside it and little markers inside that HTML. And basically this will do client-side data binding without me having to hit the server. Again, this will work against any type of backend, and you can integrate things like jQuery expressions as part of the overall template and light up and use selectors with that as well. We're also, I made an announcement, I think, last week, basically launched a new CDN at Microsoft. CDN stands for Content Delivery Network. Those are basically edge server, cache servers that live all the way around the world that you can basically cache content on top of. Benefit of that is if someone here is accessing a site that's in the U.S., instead of having to download all the content from across the Atlantic, you can basically have your scripts and your images live on an edge cache server that's located within a single network hop from anywhere inside the Netherlands or anywhere around the world that they're at. Big sites typically pay content delivery networks to do their CDN edge caching for them. What we're doing is we're putting the ASP.NET Ajax scripts as well as the jQuery scripts on top of an edge cache server that we maintain and that you can use for free. So basically ajax.microsoft.com now has jQuery and ASP.NET Ajax. Simply reference that script from within your page, and instead of it coming from your server, it'll come from our edge cache server. Our script manager control in ASP.NET 4 now also has an enabled CDN property. Set that to true, and the scripts will automatically come from our edge cache server as well. Gives you a nice performance boost, drops your bandwidth costs. There really isn't any downside to using it. What do we do with the information statistics? We actually don't do anything for privacy reasons. A lot of people wish we could, but we can't. We actually use Akamai in Limelight and a few other CDNs around the world. And for privacy reasons, we can't look at the data. Yes, the question is, what about IntelliSense? So if you point at the jQuery or at the ASP.NET Ajax library on the CDN, what happens to your IntelliSense? It still works. So we basically have both the standard libraries as well as the VS doc files loaded on those systems, and it'll work with VS 2010. It doesn't work with 2008, but it works with 2010. So let's look at a couple quick demos. So what I have here is a page that basically has a bunch of data in a grid, and I have a details view underneath here. One of the things you'll notice is I'm basically not having to, I'm not doing a full server page refresh. Instead, I'm actually doing the cursoring and the updating all on the client side, and this is taking advantage of the new client template support inside ASP.NET Ajax. The page itself here is just a vanilla HTML page. It's not even a server-side page. Based on loading jQuery, I have the new loader component in MS Ajax, and I have an application-based URL. You'll notice here I have a template file, so you can see the binding syntax that we're using here. It looks a lot like WPF and Silverlight data binding from a syntax perspective. And then you can see the details view down here as well. You notice you can bind colors, you can specify default values, and you can do binding converters, again, like you can with WPF and Silverlight. And then in my scripts folder, this is what my code looks like. So basically, I'm using the jQuery document.ready function, and basically saying when the page loads, I want to make sure that ASP.NET loads these required script components. So that'll pull it from the CDN if necessary and use those files. And then basically I'm just grabbing some data, I'm changing the locale, and then I'm basically binding it to a data view control and displaying it on the page. So a bunch of JavaScript syntax that wires up the controls, uses those UI elements, and I get the selection, the animation, all those other behaviors automatically as part of that. And so this is the entire functionality for that page that was running before. That you can take advantage of. Other benefit of using a CDN is if I visited this page and used ADO.NET and the template support, and then I visited your page and you were using the same thing, the user wouldn't have to download the file again. Instead, it would already be in their cache because we're both referencing it from a common location. And so for a lot of users, your sites will just speed up because they already have some of those scripts loaded inside their cache. Any questions on that? Bunch more Ajax improvements that I didn't mention. That gives you kind of a brief flavor of a lot of them. What do people do data access code? What do people that don't do data access code, what do you do? One of the things that we introduced with .NET 3.5 SP1 was something called the ADO.NET Entity Framework and linked to entities. Lots of feedback on ways that could be better. When people came out, I'll preface that I actually don't work on the data team, and the data team doesn't work for me. A lot of people had lots of good feedback in terms of things that they thought were missing or things that they didn't like about the Entity Framework. And the ADO.NET team has done, I think, a really great job in .NET 4 of listening to that feedback. And adding a bunch of new capabilities that really, I think, address a lot of that feedback. So specifically, some of the improvements that are coming in .NET 4. .NET 3.5 SP1 kind of pushed what we call a database-first approach, where you build your database and then you build your model off of the database. With the ADO.NET Entity Framework, it now also supports a model-first approach, where you build your models first, and then you generate your database or your mappings later at a later point in the process. It also supports something called POCO, which stands for Plain Old CLR Object. What that means is you can create classes that don't derive from base classes, that don't even have to implement any interface. You can just say public class product, add some public properties to it. If I want to have a collection, I can have an iList or an iCollection exposed as a property. I don't have to have a special entity set or any other type of ADO.NET specific object exposed. I can have a product class. Again, plain old CLR objects, they look like they were just by scratch, and then I can have all the mapping information for how to map it to and from a database stored separately. I can store that separately either inside a model file written using the Entity Framework, or the ADO.NET team's also enabling what we call a code-based approach, which allows you to use a Fluent API so that procedurally through code you can do the mapping as well. Big benefit there is for test-driven development or scenarios where you want to basically model your data access code completely independent from the database or maintain a clean separation, you now have a pretty elegant way to do that that's very IntelliSense and tool-friendly. The support lazy loading. So this way, if you get a category object and at a later point want to retrieve the products, you don't have to tell it that you're going to retrieve the products. You can just access the product's property, and on first use, it's going to load. That's kind of useful for a variety of scenarios and allows your business logic to, again, maintain more of a separation from your actual persistence layer. Supports pluralization and singularization. So if you're actually generating models from a database, it will actually, that feature in Dutch probably doesn't make as much sense. But you can have it automatically name your table so products will become a product class. And categories become a category class. The good news is you can actually make it locale aware. And so if you don't want English pluralization and singularization, you can actually write your own Dutch rules and actually plug that in as well and get Dutch-based scenarios as well. Expanded link support, so it now supports all link operators. Better foreign key support, common scenario in web apps was the desire so that that you could actually find things by foreign key. So if you wanted to have a product class with Entity Framework V1, it wouldn't expose a category ID. Instead, you'd actually have to traverse the category property, which sometimes makes sense in thick client apps, but in web apps where you're often passing IDs around in URLs, that was kind of a pain. They now have an option to directly expose that on entities. There's a disconnected API to better enable in-tier scenarios. So for example, if I want to pass entities across WCF, I can now reconnect and apply changes on other sides. And then all of the designer code generation is done through what we call T4 templates, which means that you can actually customize what the classes the designer is generating. So you can tweak and have the code look however you want when you're using the WYSIWYG designer. And again, if you don't want to use the designer, you can actually just use the code-based approach and use a Fluent API in order to find it as well. So lots of improvements. And benefits you can take advantage of. Let's do a super simple scenario that illustrates that. So, we'll just do a simple app here. Basically, I could use a code approach, but since I'm running late, I'm actually going to use Designer. I'm going to say Entity Framework. Again, start with an empty model, build it out, and then connect to the database. Or in this case here, I'm going to generate it directly from the database. I could say, hey, I want to store this connection string as Northwind. You can see these properties that give me the option to basically pluralize or singularize the objects as well as include the foreign keys. So I can basically say I want to have categories and products. I can pick the namespace. And when we do, I can later go in and refresh my model from the database, so if my schema ever changes, I can easily update it. You can see now it's, I have product and category instead of categories and products like I would have had before. My properties are also named consistently, and again, you can map in these rules. I can, we'll look at code generation in just a second, but if I want to, I can now say, Northwind And so I could say var products is equal to from P in fourth wind dot products, where P dot category, notice again you have the category ID, so if you want to do a query based on URL parameter, it's easy to do that. Dot category name is equal to beverages, select P. And then I have a grid, name of it is grid view 1. I can do grid view 1 dot data source is equal to products, grid view 1 dot data bind. So super simple scenario. Generate it, bound it, away we go. So that's sort of just standard link. It's equivalent to what you type with link to SQL. So you have, again, now full use of link when going against entities, much cleaner naming, and so on. What's the nice thing, though, is that, you remember I mentioned that you know, I could do lazy loading, I could do, I already showed the singularization and the pluralization. Let's talk a little bit about code generation. So let's say, for example, I don't want to just use the designer, I want to actually use a POCO-based approach where all of these classes can be used independently, and I can do unit testing against them without having to have a database in the picture. I can actually, on the design surface now, pick this option, which allows me to use a template. And so I can either use some of the built-in templates that we have, or I can you can write your own and plug them in, or you can even post them to our gallery. And so I'm going to create a template which is based on this EF POCO template. I'm going to name it northwind.tt. TT stands for T4. Never really thought about why it's two T's instead of four, but anyway, it stands for, it basically means it's a T4 and template. And what that does is if you actually open it up, is it's basically, it looks a little bit like an ASPX file. And you might think, God, that's ugly. But it basically gives you a lot of power to customize how content is created. Good news is you don't have to change this file or view it if you don't want to. But it basically means if you want to, for example, say, hey, it's not really the Microsoft Corporation, it's the Scott Corporation. You can change your template, and then any of the code that's generated anytime the designer changes will actually have my copy right now instead of Microsoft. If I want to add using statements or any type of behavior I want in there, I can. What this particular T4 template is doing is generating this file right here, which is a POCO class category object that has primitive properties, and basically you can see it has a products for my traversal, which is an iCollection type, and I have some validation methods that have been added as well. Doesn't derive from any base class, doesn't have to have this iValidate, this is just something I added because this is how I might want to do validation. But basically now this is just a plain old CLR object. From a unit testing perspective, I can create a category, I can create one of these products, I can return it from a repository or any other type of structure I want, and I don't need to have a database now in order to use this with my application. And again, if I want to change how the code is generated, just go into the TT file, change it however I want, hit save, and away you go. What's nice about this particular template is not only am I generating category and product as POCO types, so plain old CLR objects, this template is also generating for me a repository interface, which is based on the objects I have inside my file, and then it's also creating what we call fakes. And so, for example, I have this iNorthwind, which has a categories and products and a save changes method, which is what my Northwind context is implementing. This means that I could, inside, if I was doing something like dependency injection, I could basically have my controllers and my forms take an iNorthwind instead of a Northwind instance, work against this, and then from a testing scenario, I could new up a fake iNorthwind, pass it without ever having to hit a database. And just to make that easier, I have a fake Northwind class, which implements iNorthwind, which is basically doing an in-memory object set of data, which means that inside my unit test now, I could literally just create a unit test. I could actually say, new fake Northwind, stick some bogus products in it, pass it, and away I go. I don't have to write anything other than my 4 or 5 month unit test in order to implement that. And again, the great thing is this isn't built in. This is just inside a standard template. So if you want to use a different pattern, you want to structure your repositories in a slightly different way, just change the template. Anytime your model changes, it'll automatically be updated. Always stay up to date. Questions on that? Yeah?
In the T4 template, will you add dependencies for those
Good question. Yeah, the question is, inside those T4 templates, are we adding IntelliSense support? Not in this release, unfortunately. As much as I thought JavaScript IntelliSense was hard, believe me, this is even harder. But it is something we'll look at in the future. The good news is it is basically just VB and C#. And so that's the good news, I guess. I don't know if there's any other good news, but yeah. So the question is, for the T4 templates? Yes, the question is, can you use the T4 templates for linked to SQL? You can use a different set of T4 templates for linked to SQL. The designer out of the box does not use T4 templates, but you can actually download T4 templates that Damien Gard, D-A-M-I-E-N-G-U-A-R-D, has published that work with VS 2008 today and work with VS 2010 as well. And that allows you to customize the code generation for linked to SQL. So you can do the exact same scenario with linked to SQL. Other questions? One nice thing about the POCO work here is you can actually use iSet and iList and iCollection for your association properties, whereas I think with linked to SQL today, you still need to use EntitySet, which is still mockable and typable, but if you want to just use a generic setup interface, you can now use that here as well. Question? This will support many-to-many. The question is basically how optimized is the SQL? The AdoNet teams told me the SQL in Ado.NET is even better than it was before. So it's much more optimized, but I'm a wiser person today than I was yesterday. But if you send me an email, I can forward you to the linked entities team and the firm team, and it'd be great to take your scenario and they could comment on directly. I'm told the code generation is much better, but I don't know specifically for that scenario what it does. But if you send me mail, I can put you in touch with the developer on that team, and they can let you know for sure. So that's some work there. Obviously, this works for all types of apps, including web apps.
One question?
Yeah.
Does this new entity framework now support SQL Server 2008 geometries?
So the question is, does entity framework now support SQL 2008
geometries?
I don't know for sure. If you send me an email, I can find out. I think so, but I know that they do now support a bunch of function types, and I think custom data types, which I think might get you the geometry support. But if you send me mail, I can definitely find out for sure. Other improvements in the data space really quickly while we're going through ASP.NET. The list view control is a really popular control that we introduced in .NET 3.5. List view previously required that you always specify both a layout template and an item template. The idea was the layout template would define the Uber layout, and the item did all the items inside. You can now optionally get rid of the layout template if you want to make it simpler. We have a new query extender control, which we'll demo in a second. This works with both entities and linked to SQL, and basically allows you to easily filter results from a page. So if you've ever had a scenario where you've wanted to allow a user to say, find everyone whose name starts with G-U-T, doing that with link or with SQL can sometimes be hard to do it in a safe way that's also not susceptible to SQL injection attacks. You have to write a bunch of custom code to do it. The query extender now makes it really easy to basically enable search-like scenarios. You can do range, property, custom, etc. We'll see some demos of that in a bit. We now have this new support for what we call model-aware control validation. This is basically a scenario where, let's say you have a grid view or a forms view control, and you want to, or any data-bound control, and you basically, instead of having to write a whole bunch of code to handle events and fish out values, you instead want to just define validation rules on your actual product class and have the UI automatically reflect them. See a little bit later on in part two of my talk, I'm going to talk about ASP.NET MVC, it kind of promotes kind of this model-based validation approach. We're now enabling that for web form controls as well, and you'll see a cool demo of that in just a second. And what's nice about this is you can use this in any ASP.NET web forms app. It doesn't have to have any special dynamic data templates or any special global SAX. This is one line of code you can add inside your web forms and get built-in UI validation. We're also then adding a lot of improvements to ASP.NET dynamic data, new field templates, a new concept called entity templates. We add many-to-many support as well as inheritance support for doing scaffolding inside ASP.NET dynamic data. We're adding the, we previously, last year, shipped a set of charting controls for ASP.NET as well as Windows Forms that you can download separately and use on top of .NET 3.5 and .NET 3.5 SP1. So if you haven't taken advantage of that, search for ASP.NET chart, and the first hit will be my blog. Click it, and you can go to download it. This is now also built into ASP.NET 4 as well as Windows Forms 4. These sets of controls, they let you do standard bar charts, pie charts, stack charts. You can either do financial line charts. This has been updated for the last year. But anyway, you can see, you know, whatever type of data you want, all graphically charted, can be data bound. It also supports AJAX on the client side. Again, all built in, easy to take advantage of. Quickly show this demo, one more demo, then we'll take a break. So I thought here as we show this query extender scenario. Simple scenario, we've seen it, it's fairly ugly UI, but so apologies on that, but you've probably seen this thousands of times, or actually anytime you go to a search engine, you say, hey, I want to search on something, or I want to filter something. Let's say I want to filter on everything that starts with the letter C, or has the letter C, H, you know, and I want to do some type of filtering. You know, so common simple, I want to filter a list. Turns out that's kind of fairly hard to do in a safe way on the web. Typically the way people do it is you can't easily do it with links sometimes without having to write some custom code. And so once you want to start adding sorting, paging, and a whole bunch of other scenarios built in, that gets much harder. So for example, notice I'm still filtering, but I'm now actually doing custom order buys. If I want to do paging, things like that, you know, it's just a lot of custom code you have to write. If you're doing it with custom ADO.NET code, please be very careful because it's easy to introduce SQL injection attacks where people can fake you out and destroy your database. And so to help with that, we have this new query extender control. Basically, you can drop it on a page. You point it at a linked data source or an entity data source. You can then basically put custom search expressions. You can pull out values or programmatically push them in. You can also do things like sorting expressions, order by, range selections, etc., as well as enable full paging support as part of that. So this entire app basically only has two lines of code. Basically, it's just a grid view pointing to the linked data source and the query extender pointing to the linked data source as well. The two lines of code that we have here is basically for the details page. I'm just basically pulling out from the current item what the product ID is, and then I'm basically just generating a URL using the URL routing engine we looked at earlier to a product detail URL where I'm going to pass in an ID as a parameter. And you can see in the Global SAX what this looks like. Basically, I just have a product detail and a product list, and I've just passed in the ID as a parameter to details. So again, I'm taking advantage of URL writing in addition, or URL routing in addition to the link query thing. If we go to the details page here, and let's say I want to edit it, and I want to change this to be blank. You notice my name is required. So I have validation going on here. What's nice about the way the validation worked is you'll notice I didn't actually have to handle any events or do anything custom on the page. Instead, all I did was I said on the details view, enable dynamic validation and add the validation to be of type product. And then either in a separate class or in this case here I'm using what's called a buddy class, I've simply indicated a bunch of validation messages on top of the products, and the UI elements will directly drive their validation off of the validation you added on top of your model. So I guess this kind of enables much cleaner model view validation. You no longer need to stick anything custom to Global SAX. Just basically on your controls, enable dynamic validated data, give it the type of the object that you want to enable the validation on, and then we'll basically perform validation for you. So, other benefits we have in core ASP.NET, and there's many things I'm not talking about, but Much better caching support, so we now have pluggable output and object caching. So if you want to replicate it across a web farm, we now support that. If you want to build your own disk-based output cache provider, we now support that. We now automatically have an option to pre-start applications, so you can warm applications up before users hit them. So you can pre-populate cache entries and have those apps be super responsive the first time someone accesses them. We have new perf monitoring counters, so you can actually see on a per-app basis where you're spending your CPU time and how much memory is being allocated, something you can't do today. And we have a new syntax support inside ASP.NET Pages, angle bracket percent, colon, which allows you now to automatically HTML encode output. So you no longer have to do server.html encode. This works for both web forms and MVC. Common ask requests just makes it easy to automatically encode values. Lots more other things I'm not touching, but I thought let me just close it out with one last demo and then we'll break. We talk about deployment. So common thing you run into when you're building apps is I want to actually build an app. I want to have a different database for my tests as well as my production server. I want to turn off compilation debug support inside my web.config file. How many people don't turn off debug equals true inside their web.config file? Yeah. People say, why would I need to? I just build in release mode and everything's great, right? Do a Google search on ASP.NET debug equals true. And you'll find a blog post I did that talks about all the reasons why you don't want to do that. There's a whole bunch of performance optimizations in ASP.NET that we turn off when debug is on. Your app will get a lot faster if you turn that little value off. Now, the downside is, how do you automatically ensure that it's turned off today in 2008? Well, there's no easy way other than after you do a build, someone manually checks, or you do some kind of script that automatically scans for it. There's no way to enforce it. Well, now there is. So in 2010, you can now, for all your web.config files, create subfiles for the different configurations inside Visual Studio. So you have a debug, release, staging, testing, visiting Amsterdam, whatever you want to name the configuration, you can do it, and you can basically have a config file with settings specific to that configuration. And then when you do a build, you can add, there's now also then a publish option inside VS 2010. It'll go ahead and build, it'll apply the right settings, and then deploy your app wherever you want it to. It can be to a remote file system, it can be to a remote server, works over the internet, works through firewalls. In addition to deploying your app, we now support the ability to deploy databases, SSL security certs, custom registry entries, file ACLs. We now have a system we call the web deployment tool that you can get actually now through WebPI that runs inside IIS that allows you to deploy any type of mechanism to either a single machine or across a web farm. VS 2010 now creates manifests that use that format and directly integrates with that server. And it works great not only for your own servers, it works great in a hosted environment. So if you're in a shared host scenario where you have a dedicated or virtual host, you can point VS at it, automatically deploy your tool as well as updates to it, including database updates remotely in a secure way.
Yeah. The customized configurations, does also apply for other files than the web.config, like the system.config you use in your own application, which needs to be different between the staging and testing environment.
You can use the transformation feature that I'll talk about in just a second for any section inside your config file. So if you create your own section inside the web.config file, you can absolutely use the transformation syntax there. Now, if you create your own config files with a different format, we don't natively support that, although I think there is a build event hook that you can tie into, which would allow you to do that. But in general, what we probably recommend is create your own config sections, stick them in the config file, and then you can basically just tie in directly to the system. So let's see a quick demo of this in action. So I have a simple deployment app here. You notice here, this is my root web.config file. So you notice I have two connection strings inside the config file, one called Northwind Entities, one called Application Services. I then have a compilation debug equals true. Switch that I can set to true or false. Right now it's set to true. You'll notice then inside my project I now have a .debug and a .release configuration. Those are added by default when you create a new project now and it targets .NET 4. These files don't duplicate the content. Oh, actually, by the way, I also set up membership roles and a few other things inside this config file that are app specific. What's nice about these subconfig files is they don't duplicate the content that's already in your master web.config file. Instead, it just, oops, that's not the one I wanted to open. Instead, it just actually has the transformations to take the root web.config file and transform it however you want when you're in a release configuration. And so what I have here from my compilation is you'll notice it says, we have an exit, this interface basically says, remove the debug attribute. And so this will basically unset debug equals true when it's actually being deployed in a release environment. Likewise, for the connection string, it's basically saying, effectively match and set the value of the connection string on the Northwind entity's entry inside that config file. And so you can do that for any type of element. You can inject elements, remove elements. Basically, it's sort of a grammar we support that's XML-based, allows you to easily transform anything you want inside that config file. And now there's also then a publish dropdown here. You can see I can actually have a release or a debug deployment. There's a button for publish, but it was cropped because I have a small screen. Hit publish, and it actually just published my app. What did it do? Click on here, and you can basically see here the different settings that you can maintain. So I can have a debug and a release version here. I can tell it a directory to deploy to. Alternatively, I can actually just point to an FTP server. We now support secure FTP. And IIS now has a secure FTP server, so you can use that. We also then have this option called MS Deploy Publish. This is an HTTP-based publish deployment mechanism. Can work secure, can mark apps as applications in IIS remotely, allows certificates, and allows you to connect in a delegated way. So in other words, if you get a hosting account that's shared, where there's 1,000 people in the box, they can still give you the URL, you paste it in here, username, password, you can deploy to that shared hosting site directly within Visual Studio. It'll only copy the files that changed. And what's nice is if you pull up the project properties, in addition to allowing you to configure a whole bunch of stuff specific to ASP.NET apps, you notice there's a deploy SQL option, which allows you to, for example, import your connection strings from your web.config file. And then I could actually say, hey, let's actually automatically import the schema as well as the data from this database and automatically generate a .sql file, copy to the remote server, and then basically update it into the database on the remote server, all in an automated way. You could also do change scripts. So if you want to go ahead and do deltas to a database that's already deployed, you can now easily do that. Again, you can change the schema and the data, or just the data only. You can auto-generate the scripts, or you can manually add your own .sql file. So if you want to use something like Redgate or some of the new database tools that we're shipping in the enterprise editions of Visual Studio, you can use that as well, model your schema, and update your system. And again, once you do this, hit publish, it'll generate it. And one last thing I'll just show, just in time, let me just copy that URL. Is if you go inside the IIS admin tool and have the MS Deploy WebPI package installed, so you do that through the web platform installer I showed earlier, you notice there's now both an export and an import package option. You can point to a file, the package, zip file, and disk. You can choose what things you actually want to import as part of that. So if there was a database option, I could actually check or uncheck the database. I could actually set any ACLs or anything like that. Hit next, I could give the name of a site I want to create, so we'll call this Netherlands. Hit next. This basically just deployed my app inside IIS using the admin tool. And now if I go here, there's my Netherlands application running on my system, fully configured. If I had a database, it would install that. It could install my SSL certs, any registry entries, etc. So much easier to go ahead and deploy an app. You can give that zip file to an admin. They can use this tool or just point it in a remote server, either through within Visual Studio or through a command line tool, push it, and away you go. All the production stuff will also work on build servers. So if you use TFS, you can have every build script actually automatically generate the package unit, push it to a remote test server, and start testing with it automatically as well. So a lot of great improvements around deployment. So I mentioned a whole bunch of stuff I didn't talk about at the beginning of the talk, and yet I still almost managed to do 2 hours. So I apologize for the delay. But hopefully you saw here lots of improvements coming for web development. Lots more stuff even in the web development space I didn't get a chance to touch on. A couple things I wanted, a key thing, I hope the theme you saw a little bit was There's not like radically new things that you need to learn in order to take advantage of value. A lot of these things are fairly easy concepts to pick up, things that you can immediately apply, hopefully immediately solve pain points that you have today, and both in the tool as well as the framework. Hopefully you'll find lots of things that you can immediately start applying to make your apps better. Included also with Visual Studio 2010 and .NET 4 will be ASP.NET MVC 2. So no number of people here are doing MVC development. I'm going to show a preview of that after we break here in a little bit. But that will also be built in. I didn't cover it as part of this talk, so I'm going to cover it as part of the second talk. Lots more improvements to WPF, lots of improvements to Silverlight, lots of improvements to Windows Forms, a lot more data improvements I didn't touch on, a lot of the SDS improvements, great C-sharp, VB, language improvements, a new F-sharp language for doing functional programming, C++ improvements, SharePoint improvements, a whole bunch of other stuff I didn't mention. So even more stuff to talk about in future releases, but hopefully this gave you a little flavor of some of the stuff that's coming. Beta 2 will be here shortly. The Beta 2 release will have a go-live license for .NET, so all the features I showed here you can start building on in a few weeks and actually deploy into production if you so choose. And hopefully take advantage of some of the things that are coming. So any last-minute questions on this before we break? Question in the back. Yeah?
You said beta 2 release?
When is the final ETA? Release? Oh, the ETA on the beta 2 release? We haven't announced a date yet, mainly because we want to make sure we hit it. So we are in the basically in the final stages of finishing up the beta 2 release now. After I finish the talk, I got to go back and make sure my team hit it. The goal of today, but basically we're in the final bug fix phase. We'll sit on that build for a little while to make sure that we don't find regressions. Sometimes we reset escrow a couple times, but we're not too far off. I expect to see it in the not too distant future. And there's a few surprises and other nice features that I didn't talk about today that sort of save a little bit of surprise for beta 2. But hopefully not too distant future. Yeah, so the question is, there's two questions, or there's one question there that might be, I'll give you two answers. There is a full .NET framework that we support, which is what I've been using here, for building desktop and server-based applications on top of Windows. Separately, we have something called the .NET Compact framework, which is compatible with this framework, but which is targeting mobile devices as well as embedded devices. So it's used on Xbox, it's used on Windows mobile devices. For Silverlight, we're using it for Silverlight on Nokia, as well as Silverlight on Windows CE and some of the other embedded scenarios that we've announced publicly. And so we continue to support that. You'll see a mobile tools update for Windows Mobile 7 that will support with Visual Studio 10, and we'll continue to use the Compact framework for that. Now, we're also then enabling what we call a client edition of the .NET framework. That's something we introduced with .NET 3.5 SP1 with that previous release. Was that the one you were asking about? Okay. That basically is designed for client apps. It's much smaller in size and doesn't have all the server features that are required for things like ASP.NET. With .NET 3.5 SP1, basically the way the client SKU worked is it was a complete replacement for the full .NET framework. And so when you install the full .NET framework on top of it, it would basically replace all the files and then add its own. What we've done in .NET 4 is we kind of cleanly layered it so that the full .NET framework effectively includes the client framework and then a few additional files on top. Makes it easier for us to service, makes it easier for you to use. I think the client version of the framework is going to be about 23 megabytes in size, so it's still fairly small. The full .NET framework is going to be about 36 megabytes in size. So it's actually much smaller than .NET 3.5 SP1. We actually kind of rewrote our setup technology to make it a lot smaller. So the client one still exists. It's about 23, 24 megabytes in size. The full .NET framework is about 36.5 megabytes in size for 32-bit edition. That includes everything that's in the .NET framework today. And then we also have a 64-bit version that supports both 64-bit and 32-bit for WoW purposes. I think that's about 53 megabytes. So you can choose whichever package you want. So for client apps, by default, when you build a WinForms or WPF client, it targets the client package now. Yeah, and the other nice thing about .NET 4 is because it's side-by-side release, today if you install .NET 3.5 SP1, the client edition, and there's a previous version of .NET 2 or later on the machine, we actually have to service the machine, which takes a lot longer to set up. Because .NET 4 is a completely side-by-side release, the install time on a machine that doesn't have it installed is always the same, and it's going to be relatively quick. So, with that, how about we break and then come back? How long? Half an hour? Okay. Come back in half an hour, and I can do part two of the talk, which is ASP.NET MVC. So thanks a bunch, and we'll see you back there.